Machete Mate recognizes the traditional owners of the land on which we are recording. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and any indigenous elders of other communities who may be listening today. We stand in solidarity in their struggle towards the colonization and land back. Buena mi gente, what is good? Machete Mate back after a couple of weeks. We're slowly getting back on track, kind of, I guess. I don't know. And by back on track is just team myself from the normal, from the OG group. But again, just like with our last recording, we have our on the floor, on the ground, Australia correspondent, good comrade of ours, friend of the show, one of our favorite people, Rev's back with us.
That's good.
Here he is. Really, really good seeing and catching him up at the rally last week. But that's, we'll get to that. The more specifics about that. But in saying that, like I said, I am Leroy, coming to you from unceded Wurundjeri land down here in Narm. We've got T. What is going on, T?
How's it going? Doing okay. Got off work a little while ago, so you know that's always nice. Looking forward to talking with you fellas about this stuff. You know, very grim and very difficult things, but also positive things and stunning examples of both courage and solidarity the world over. So, you know, looking forward to talking to you fellas about this subject and kind of continuing from our last episode.
Oh, 100%, man. And like I said before, we have Rev back on from my part of the world. What's going on, man?
What's good, guys? Thanks so much for having me on again. I really, really enjoy talking to you guys.
Yeah, beautiful. Slowly replacing the self-proclaimed, what did he call himself? They call himself the Maradona or the Messi of the group or something.
Well, who are you talking about again? I don't know who you're talking about.
Some guy you're related to, I think.
Like, as far as I know, it's just been our show, you know, so I don't know what we're talking about. Like, I've never heard of such a person.
I don't know, man. But no, if he's listening, hopefully he is. Get your shit together and because it's all good. It's all good. That's us talking bullshit.
It's all love.
It's all love. But yeah, before we get into it, because I'm sure we have a lot to talk about, because knowing the three of us, we could just talk ad nauseum about everything we're going to talk about. Just a few highlights so we can start this on a positive note, because I know it's going to descend into like just harrowing, just doomerism at some point, as much as we try not to, but because that's just the way the world works. So what's been going on, team, man? What's good, man? How's picks of the week?
Picks of the week. Goodness gracious. I mean, I don't really have anything to like in specific, besides, you know, just kind of the really extraordinary demonstrations and rallies that have been occurring just worldwide. I really believe that this is really bringing anti-imperialism in a really strong way into people's consciousness, into their political practice, more importantly. I think people are asking the kind of difficult questions about how does global capital function? How does the empire actually function? Yeah. Right. In the United States, especially, last time we spoke, it was fresh off of Joe Biden's Genocide Joe's country, where he explicitly, sort of linked American jobs with the war machine. So I think, people are starting to really question that and questioning the utility of sort of looking for saviors among the political class versus looking for, looking to those who are besides them on the street as the ones, we will free ourselves, right? We are taking inspiration from the people, from the Palestinian people. They are the vanguard of the world's struggle right now. They are truly the vanguard. And, for every bit of, we have to match their courage, if we possibly can.
Just quickly, let me jump in there. Like on that last point, there's that saying that's going around basically stating that they're not only trying to decolonize, but they're also decolonizing all of us as well.
Oh, yeah.
Which is like pretty true. So people that everyday people that you wouldn't are not necessarily politically aware or whatever you want to say, are starting to, you know, awaken to what's going on and to the ideas of decolonization. But really, really positive thing to see, unfortunately, for such a terrible situation. But yeah, man. How about you, Rev? What's good, man?
Yeah, I echo what you guys are saying there. Obviously, ideally, you wouldn't need something like the genocidal offensive that right. Israel and the United States are collaboratively conducting against Palestinians in Gaza right now to actually have this kind of politicization take place. But unfortunately, I think, you know, these days when organizations of the left are much more marginal and less, you know, strong and cohered as in previous eras, this kind of mass, you know, atrocity or struggle is what really, you know, actually kind of gets those ideas circulating again and getting people out onto the streets and opposing it as much as they can. I think, you know, you saw that with Black Lives Matter to a kind of more micro extent, given that yeah. it was, you know, just the assassination of George Floyd that kicked it off. But that represented, you know, a far more mass phenomenon, obviously. It was distilled in that horrific video that set people off. So I think people similarly have been set off by the horrific videos and images that we're getting out of Gaza. Many of them brought to us directly by Palestinian journalists on the ground who, you know, have garnered millions and millions of followers on social media, which shows you how many people are paying attention on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah.
And that really, that's a really important point that, you know, especially, and this is kind of a another commonality between the 2020 uprisings and not just that one, but the ones before and subsequent, you know, against, you know, racist police murders. As well as this, as well as the genocidal attacks against the Palestinians, is that everybody has a camera now, man. Yeah, everybody's got a fucking camera in their back pocket, right? The vast majority of the way the internet has arrived to the global South has been cell phones, right? You can't fucking hide shit no more, man. You can't fucking hide it. You know, back in the day, you know, people could be like, oh, that cop really didn't say that to you, or that really didn't happen. Where's your proof, right? Nah, not anymore, man. And God, those journalists just fucking like, God, I yeah, am man. Just, yo, for real, the doctors too, and the nurses yeah. in these fucking hospitals that are getting shelled as we speak, right? I what do they call it today or yesterday? The day of the war of the hospitals or some, yes. some really
yeah,
kind
today.
Of
yeah. Yeah. They bombed. Yeah. They went crazy.
Well, oh man.
Pretty much every hospital. Even tank shells and machine gun fire, snipers as well, targeting hospitals. Yeah.
Yep.
And the thing is, the world is seeing it, like, because they, you know, people got cell phones, people got ways to get the information out, even with the blackouts, even with the destruction of their communications, like, they're still getting that information out there. I mean, hell, fuck, like the even the Hamas fighters with their crazy videos of them, like, I bro, like. I saw one of those where the dude went around, so I'm sure most people who are listening, and I'm sure you fellas have seen it. This fucking guy in like a tracksuit, man, just fucking runs up on a damn tank, just drops his little bomb and runs off, and it blows up, and he's shouting and shit like that. I'm just amazed at just the courage to face that kind of assault, and they're being very smart, honestly. I swear the if it wasn't for the overwhelming dominance of the mainstream press's support of the Israeli state, if there was in any way some sort of parody in terms of like quote unquote the propaganda lines from both sides, I think the Palestinian side would like more people would view both and be like, holy shit, God, I know where I stand.
Yeah. 100%. And talking the media, let's put a pin in that because I think I want to start off the conversation about just the positive experiences. So the positive experiences we had at the rallies and maybe work our way backward from that. Because again, like this will probably just descend into just like nightmarish. Like I know I tend to cry easily. You know what I mean? I'm very emotional. Too, so I know I'm going to, I know, like, I was tearing up three a few of times. Us. It makes the three of us, right? But yeah, so maybe we'll start there. Like I said, every Sunday here in Melbourne, I'm pretty sure across Australia as well, but at least here every Sunday, there's been massive rallies. I managed to finesse my way out of work last Sunday, so I was able to go. Rev has been to all of them thus far. In my experience, that was perhaps one of the most incredible coming together of people I've ever been a part of. Easily 100k. Like, the official stats are anywhere from 50 to 80k, which tells you it's probably more like 100k.
Right.
And yeah, and Rev reckons as well that, like, it's this is probably the biggest one, and then this next one's probably going to be even bigger. And what's very heartwarming is you see everybody's there, different people, like different races, different nationalities, all sorts of flags of, like, every country, all in unison, freaking kids leading chants. Like, I remember Rev and I found each other, and we were marching, and there's kids all around us, like, leading chants and stuff. And it was like the most, and like, I'm sure on a few occasions it was like parents kind of, you know, guiding their kids, but like a few times they're just kids just started shouting, and the parents are like, kind of like, this is what he's doing, you know what I mean? And that was, it was very, I don't even know if there's a word for it. It was very, like, heartening. It was very just like in that moment, there was nothing else to think but, like, we're going to win this. Like, we're going to win. You know what I mean? I mean, we're up against global capital. We're up against nuclear armed powers, but we have solidarity on our side. You know what I mean? From the youngest person, like, in the entire crowd, there was people, like, disabled folks in wheelchairs, like, marching. There were, like, Rev's grandparents were there marching, you know what I mean? And it was a really hot day. It was, like, one of the longest routes I've ever been a part of, and, like, they were there proud. Like, it was such an incredible thing to see as well. And, like, going back to flags, we saw, like, heaps of Turkish flags, obviously the Palestinian flags. I had my Puerto Rican flag. There was Bosnian flags, West Papuan, Maltese, like, heaps of indigenous flags. And that was another thing as well, and it's something that we mentioned before, I think on our last episode, how we can tie the experience, the indigenous experience here, and the contradiction of having a fucking, like, voice referendum fail, and then all the liberals, quote unquote, solidarity. But that was there. You saw Dr. Gary Foley, who's a lifelong, like, legendary activist in Australia, an indigenous man, saying that, I've been marching for Palestinian solidarity since, like, the 60s. Like, for decades coming out. And this is one of the most respected indigenous activists, like, in the entire country, saying, like, I, you know, cut my teeth marching for Palestine. You know what I mean? Like, way back in the day. So it was quite incredible. And, like, the different, like, political groups, like the Vic Socialists were out there, Socialist Alliance, Socialist Alternative. There was a tent giving out free Qurans and stuff. Like, there was a lot of, like, Jewish comrades out there, like, speaking, like, this is basically, like, this is bullshit. Like, this, you know, we grew up learning, like, oh, not, like, never again. But, like, then we get to a certain age and they forget that never again includes everybody. You know what I mean? Pretty heartwarming to see representatives from, like, from unions and stuff. But, yeah.
Yeah, totally. I think just a few really quick things on that. It's really important that warriors of the Aboriginal resistance, who are kind of like,
yeah,
the more activisty, more radical left-wing Indigenous activists here in Melbourne, have been helping Free Palestine Melbourne and the Australian Palestinian Advocacy Network actually conduct the rally. So they've thrown all their resources and their support behind the movement to free Palestine, and are kind of very prominent at the rallies now. Every single rally, you know, you'll have, obviously, you know, land acknowledgements and this kind of thing, but you'll have several Indigenous speakers coming from different perspectives to, yeah, you know, basically enforce, you know, the fact that this is a related struggle. It's an anti-colonial struggle. Both represent resistance and persistence in the face of colonialism. Yeah. And obviously, you know, when it comes to the Palestinians now, they're facing the forces of global imperialism effectively conspiring against them. And I think the Black People's Union, which is another left-wing Indigenous group, held an anti-imperialist rally midweek to draw attention to that specific dynamic as well. So definitely there is a politicization on the left, I'd say, around, you know, colonialism particularly and anti-imperialism, as you led with, T. That's definitely happening. And they are huge rallies. Like, they are the biggest that we've seen since, I would say, Invasion Day, which is the kind of big annual protest against the day that European colonists arrived in so-called Australia, right? So I think there's room to grow because the movement is still quite new. And that's, you know, really interesting and exciting to be part of every week, seeing the dynamism of the crowd that Leroy went through and the kind of growth in numbers as well. And each week they get angrier and angrier at the Labour Party, who, just like the Democrats in the United States, have been completely feckless. They've refused to even so much as criticize Israel, let alone call for a ceasefire or anything like that. You know, they just repeat the same hollow lines about, we hope that they follow international law, when clearly for 5 weeks now they haven't been doing that, so on and so forth, right? So they are getting angrier and they're getting bigger every single week.
Yeah, 100%. And it's quite amazing to watch.
I think it's interesting too, like, the last time I've seen this many, like, families, you know, normally at a left-wing protest, you know, if you're on the left, you know, and if you've been on the left for a while, you eventually, like, you see the usual suspects all the time, right? You know, no shade against that, because we're one of the usual suspects too, obviously. And then you know something's different when, like, oh, the crowd's bigger, there's more people. And then there's a level above that, which is, oh, there's whole ass families here.
Yeah.
There are elders and there are kids, you know, mothers with strollers. There's like little kids and shit like that. And that's when you know you're kind of, like, either your action, your demo, whatever it is, has kind of crossed several important lines, right? It's very different. I'm thinking of a picture that Molly Conger at Socialist Dogmom Online, friend of the show for a couple of reasons. my beautiful partner, she went to the DC demonstration and she took a picture that was very striking. I recommend you look up her Twitter and look at it. But it's a young girl. It's a little girl, I don't know, like 8, maybe younger, standing at the bars in front of the White House. And there's like a line of riot cops on the other side of the light on the other side of the wall. And it's just, like, it's such a striking image that, like, whether it's DC or the occupied territories, like, this little girl was probably experiencing one of the most formative moments of her life. Like, she probably got family over there that face, and she hears stories about facing the police, facing, you know, these enemies. And there's one thing that you'll notice if you look at demonstrations worldwide is that the police all look the fucking same, man. They all kid out the same fucking way, man. No, seriously, like, I know who my enemy is, right? Our comrades in the occupied territories and who their enemies are. I that's what struck me is not just the size of the crowds, but the fact that there's whole families there, that the ages are very kind of widespread. And I guess now hearing from y'all, especially in the United States, Jewish left-wing Jewish people in the United States have been just fucking, like, on fire, man. Like, amazing. Just
so militant.
Like, truly, truly, like, I'm getting, like, honestly chills just, like, talking about it right now.
100%.
Like, constantly defying every fucking police order, every politician, getting, you know... it's astonishing to me, and it just shows how backwards this world is, how Jewish left-wing groups, on especially campus groups and universities, are getting, you know, just truckloads, the cops are arresting truckloads of Jewish people, throwing them in jail because apparently these Jewish people are anti-Semitic or something, or they're the bad guys in the situation. It's just absolutely astonishing to me. I saw a fucking headline earlier today where it was Marine Le Pen urges her followers to march against anti-Semitism. What the fuck, dog? What world is this when Jews protesting genocide are labeled anti-Semitic, but this fucker who comes from a political party that descends from Vichy, descends from Vichy is now is like some hero. I don't. It's crazy.
Yeah, and just on that note, there's another headline the other day. Someone tweeted out like confused, like because the headline was Marie Le Pen supports Israel, and like the thing was like, oh, this is such a contradiction. I'm like, if you understand anything about reactionary politics, about anti-Semitism, about fascism, this is not a contradiction. These are both supporters of like ethno-nationalism. For fasc, Israel represents a place where the eternal enemy, you know what I mean, the mystical like puppeteers, they can all, you know, fuck off to, you know what I mean. And it's and it's wild that just the contradiction there is the fact that the very things that have caused this valid generational trauma among the Jewish populations that has sort of been distilled into the concept of Zionism is that contradiction. What I mean, how it's both this place where they can go to feel free, but they will never be safe. And it's just it's a self like I'm losing my words. It's like a self eating, you know, ideology. I don't know.
This shit makes me feel like I'm huffing gasoline. Like just like the way that the Western press is presenting it and the way that reactionary politics are taking it.
Yeah. I think when it comes to anti-Semites like Marine Le Pen and, you know, the party that she heads up attend these kind of rallies, it's really important to note that they're not rallying against anti-Semitism. They're rallying in support of the state of Israel and Zionism.
Yeah,
and exactly. They're also rallying against Muslims. They're rallying against Arabs, and they're attempting to intimidate the Muslim and Arab population of France, who have been under, you know, incredible amounts of persecution. I call it racial McCarthyism, which I think has now blanketed the entire West for years in the build-up to the next, you know, presidential election, which Macron won't be able to stand in again. But he, in order to kind of wedge Le Pen, has actually adopted and intensified this Islamophobic persecution, right? So they've set the platter. And I think in many ways you can see that in Australia as well and some other places around Europe, like Germany, where, you know, I think the so-called liberals and sensible center and whatever have actually laid the table perfectly for the electoral fascist parties to come in during this crisis and actually take control of the state. I think that's really important, just because at the end of the day, like the Palestinians en masse in Palestine today are Muslims, and they threaten the Western imperialist and colonialist hegemony in the Middle East and around the world by struggling against it. So, you know, calling all Muslims terrorists and this kind of thing is really, really important for the bourgeoisie of the West to actually, you know, persecute this, you know, this effectively tiny group of people in the Middle East on behalf of Israel.
No, that's that's the thing. Like capitalists in every society, you know, they always need a subsection of the working class that's even more hyper exploitable than the larger working class, right? So in the United States, it was, you know, it was black people. It was basically non-white people are the hyper-exploitable class. In a lot of places in Western Europe, especially Muslim and Arab migrants and North African migrants function the same way. It's a hyper-exploitable group, right? So they take they're forced into the shit jobs with the very low pay that allows them to then play one side of the working class off of the other. There, you know, it's the classic, you know, it's the divide and conquer game, of course. Not to say that there are like legitimate and genuine white supremacists and Islamophobes. Like it's not all just like cynical top hatted capitalists with monocles, like looking at their numbers. They're there, of course. But among those top hatted monocle capitalists are sincere racists, right?
Yeah.
I think that it's kind of, like I said, I feel like I'm huffing gasoline right now.
No, 100%. And I think going back to the French point as well, I think one of the most profound quotes is from the soccer player Karim Benzema. So world-class player, really famous. He's French of Algerian descent. And he has this quote where he said that, when I score, I'm French. Otherwise, I'm just Algerian. And this is a man who's been like one of the top French players for years, represents France internationally, is incredible. But he said Madrid, he plays for Real Madrid. And he's like, growing up my entire life, like I'm only considered French when I'm scoring. When I'm not scoring, I'm a dirty Arab, essentially. And he was recently chastised, and I don't know if he was like censured or like suspended, whatever, for posting one of the most milquetoast just Palestinian solidarity like stories or something like that, basically saying like solidarity with the Palestinians, and that was just too much. But yeah, we're definitely seeing that, and we're definitely seeing that here in Australia as well, like Rev mentioned, with the Labour Party. But also shout out to the Greens to a certain degree for actually making a stand the other day in Parliament. Rev, I don't know if you can speak more to that, but they came out. I think it was Osmani. She came out and was really, really, you know, spoke out on behalf of Palestinians and like Australia's role and like the West's role in everything.
Yeah, 100%. I think the Greens' position on this is a real credit to their membership. Obviously, these are not radical leftists, though there are radical leftists in the Greens. They still constitute a very small minority of the overall membership of the party. And the Australian Greens is very similar to other Greens parties around the world. But for American listeners, it's much more credible and mainstream and prominent than the one in the United States, where people effectively have no participation or interaction with it at all, except protest votes in the presidential elections. Like, the Greens have several members from all across Australia in the federal parliament, but they also form important parts of local state governments as well. So they are like effectively the third kind of largest party in Australia, aside from the two major parties. And I think their position has been driven from the bottom up by their membership to actually take and not only like a ceasefire now position for this particular genocide, but an anti-occupation position, one that actually demands an end to the occupation, an end to the siege of Gaza, an end to, you know, in general, like Israel's systematic denial of the rights of Palestinians to self-determination. And they've been making that case. They've been the sole party, actually, even though it's in the Labour Charter and kind of their official policy program to support a Palestinian state and all this kind of stuff. They've been silent about it right now.
Yeah.
But the Greens have actually taken a stand, and I think they've been an important part of getting younger white people to the rallies. Once the Greens really started promoting the rallies and throwing their resources into it, like among their actual activist networks, I started to see a lot more people around my age, like 20 to 30 years old, who were not, you know, from oppressed backgrounds and like, you know, Muslim or anything like that, actually showing up to the rallies, which is fantastic.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say 100% on that. And this would be it'll be very interesting to see how they perform at the next election as well, because I know I work the polls locally here where I live. And like I've mentioned before, it's heavily Middle Eastern, a lot of Muslim, Arab, Assyrian, everything. Labor ended up winning the area because it's a comfortable Labor seat, but they lost like half of like the vote share that they would have normally. Like, they swung down incredibly, but they were only carried over the line by the share of the Green vote, and actually the share of the Victorian Socialist vote as well. So it'll be very interesting to see if the Greens are able to use this going forward. The Victorian Socialists have such a great opportunity here as well, especially up here, because I'm seeing people walking around here with the Free Gaza t-shirts, Free Palestine t-shirts that were going at the rally that say like socialist alternative, socialist. So socialist isn't a dirty word anymore. Like, it's losing like that sort of stigma. And the fact that like, it's socialist groups that are front and center in solidarity with their ostensible like siblings from the region, I think that'll go a long way to creating a very interesting situation in the next couple elections.
So I got a question for y'all fellas. Is the, you know, I know unfortunately you are forced to be aware of U.S. politics and U.S. cultural and political trends I, being an ignorant American, aren't required to learn about all the other Anglophone countries. I'm wondering, is the kind of fanaticism for the Israeli state that you see in the Democrat Party here in the United States, is it similar in the Labor Party down there, or is it not the same?
It's different. It's cold and calculated and kind of like dispassionate, and all framed around the rights of Jewish people and defending them from anti-Semitism and things like that. It's less literally like Zionist, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Even though they are obviously Zionist, like they keep that stuff kind of in their personal sort of activities, as opposed to like their statements and their kind of publicly prosecuted lines. So like many of them go on trips to Israel sponsored by Israel. Many of them, you know, attend events held by the Zionist Federation of Australia and these kind of peak Zionist lobby bodies here. And they, you know, peddle Zionist ideology in the speeches they give at those events when they're invited, and so on and so forth. But they kind of keep that out of the mainstream a little bit here. It's definitely a bit different. Yeah.
Interesting. Because in the United States, I mean, the Congress just censored Rashida Tlaib. The fucking conscience, the moral center of that fucking den of vipers, man, in DC. Like she's like head and shoulders above the fucking, like, yeah, for real, like, salute, for real, just head and shoulders above the rest of them.
Let me just jump in here on that very note. On that specific topic, let me just say and declare, and I think we've been very clear on the show, fuck Richie Torres, fuck Ben Soto, fuck those motherfuckers. You are scum. You are an embarrassment to Puerto Ricans. Fuck both of you. Darren Soto, fucking, like Rev, I was telling you, Darren Soto's my rep from back home. He represents, you know, District 9, Kissimmee, Florida. Kissimmee's like the freaking... what Broad Meadows is to Arabs here, like Kissimmee is for Puerto Ricans over there. And this motherfucker consistently voting on the wrong side of fucking history. This motherfucker, like, his suits are too big and too small for him at the same time. Like, he's a fucking piece of shit. Like, him and his fucking Midwest emo, like, acoustic music. Fuck Richie Torres. Like,
Richie Torres.
But on that note, shout out Nelia Velasquez, who is Puerto Rican, who backs Rashida Tlaib. I just want to get that off my chest because fuck both of them, man.
Richie Torres is just, he's a really just a really despicable little worm, right? They want to promote him as like one of their, like, a future guy for their party. I'm very, you know, it's pretty Hakeem obvious. Jeffries
type spec, you know, try to get him into that kind of role. Like, he would never run for anything, but he would be like a great whip or whatever, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To roll out.
Yeah, I don't know, you know, so people, you know, challenging him is kind of a fool's errand in some, and what I mean by that, not like challenge, like running against him or anything like that, but you're not going to move him, right? He cannot be convinced. You know, I would say everybody, you know, people in the United States, you know, especially left wingers, tend to like, will sort of, excuse me, will dismiss or kind of poo-poo calling the congressperson, right? Now, yeah, I get it. It seems small, but there was a news report that came out, I think it was yesterday, where staffers were like shocked and complaining about the number of calls and things like that. If anything, to more anarchistic inspired listeners who might not want to engage with the state at all, look, if you want to really irritate, do you want your congressperson to have a bad day? Do you want their staffer to have a bad day? Just make your fucking calls. It's something small. It takes 5 minutes. It annoys them. All right. Beyond, you know, obviously go to the demos, all that good stuff. But like, take a 5 minutes in the morning with your morning coffee or tea to give a staffer a bad day. You know how you hate work when the first customer walks in and they're a dick and it just kind of makes the whole day shitty? You can do that for your local congressional office. You can ruin their day. It is It is easy. There's a great Five Calls, I think is the name of the, Five Calls. It's an app. You can download the fucking app. You can just give them a bad day, you know? Speaking of like shitty Congress people, got like Fetterman's behavior has been truly incredible. Like we all knew he was like bad on this issue, but like the pettiness of it all now is kind of stunning. Bernie Sanders' lack of leadership. Again, we all knew this position about him. This was always his thing. It's a generational thing most with Bernie. Regardless though, his lack of leadership on this has been I'll admit it, it's been disappointing, right? I never put much stock as him as like this, like, you know, he was gonna be our fucking like our Lenin who was gonna lead us, who was gonna be our Lenin who was gonna lead us into the fucking utopia or whatever. No, but I mean, even just a little bit of leadership, like even maybe why isn't he calling for a ceasefire or you know, something simple as that, right? His lack of leadership has been interesting. It's only like the squad in the House of Representatives that have been good on this. But make your calls, people, you know, especially if you're like me and like you work a shit job and you never have fucking time for anything. You can barely get out to demos and things like that. Spending the morning 5 minutes with your coffee or your tea and just knowing that you annoyed someone is just one small thing you can do in addition to like going out and about on in your life.
Yeah, 100%. And I saw just before people on that, you know, saying exactly what you're saying, but also pushing the idea that they need to have physical, like we just make this more physical for them. So actually faxing like letters and emailing letters and stuff like that. So it's a physical thing that they can take to like the congressperson. It's not just like 20-year-old just manning phones all day. You know what I mean? Because at the end of the day, like, if the congressperson doesn't want to hear it, they're just going to walk away. You know what I mean? But if there's a stack of fucking papers that you can throw in their face, that may sway them personally. Because right now, the people this is affecting, again, just like under any other job under capitalism, it's the workers that are working like the offices. Like it's the staffers that are like, you know, eating the shit and having to deal with this. I mean, they should all just quit their jobs. Like I'm not giving them the benefit of the doubt or anything, but like it's still not precipitating its way up to the Congress people as much as we want. So direct action, showing up, making it physical, making it like unavoidable and unmissable.
And speaking of working class people getting involved in shit, the most gangster ass, like hard bodied protests that have happened are these demonstrations at the ports and at factories and labor unions refusing to send the shipments out, right? If at least in the United States, there's always a constant debate, like how, you know, what is anti-imperialism to the labor movement, right? Because, you know, here in the United States, we're really still trying, like we're trying to rebuild the labor movement after decades of decline, right? You know, so like, how do you bring anti-imperialism and labor together? Well, you have that right there. You have unions involved. Like I know in Canada I saw a clip of like fucking people who work in arms factories walking, right? Because of what's going on. You have longshoremen in various countries refusing to load up the ships. That is a clear, direct blow against the war machine, right? That is, what is it using? It is using the ultimate power, which is our power to say, fuck you, you know, take this job and shove it, right? Taking that power for anti-imperialist aims, right? It's and you're seeing it more and more in other countries. And, you know, like you said, Rev, you're noticing at y'all's rallies that people are getting angry and angrier. You know, eventually, I mean, this, look at 2020, man. Shit exploded because people could not, like, people were not getting heard. People could see the brutality. People saw the indifference in their leaders. And what's going to happen is everybody's going to be much like how this whole thing got fucking started. People are going to act really surprised when they start seeing police departments in flames again. They're going to act like, where did this happen? Where did this come from? Oh, you don't know? No. You're being willfully obtuse right now. I know your works, evil one.
Yeah. 100%. And like just like the Barcelona dock workers union refusing, we've had some manifestations here as well, down at the ports here in Melbourne as well, blocking trucks. Yeah. You know,
and Maritime Workers Union has effectively spoken at rallies and made their position really clear that they won't support arms to Israel and that kind of thing.
Yeah, 100%. I think we had a ship turn around that completely just refused to dock and just turned around. One of the representatives of the dock, the Maritime Workers Union here, was talking about last time how they have sent in the past like brigades to Palestine to build like those bridges and relationships, even before all of this. So that basis of solidarity was already there. So it was just a natural like, well, these are our working class brothers that we've been talking with them for ages. Like, you know, fuck y'all. Like, this is the right thing to do. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Specifically making connections with Palestinian trade unions and workers in Palestine. Yeah.
Yeah.
God, so that's the fucking fire, man. That's the shit right there. That's how things move, man. That people talk about engines and motors of history. Well, that's how you prime it, baby. Like that's how it's done.
International proletariat. But I mean, what we're talking about, I guess, that internationalism, like shout out to the protests in Puerto Rico as well. Like last week they had a massive one where our boy Tito Kayak, who has a kind of a controversial figure in Puerto Rico, but he's always out at the protests. He's the guy that's always climbing flagpoles and changing flags or whatever. He climbed the Capitol building in San Juan, took down the U.S. flag because, you know, it's the U.S. flag that flies over Puerto Rico, took it down and put up a Palestinian flag. And that was incredible. And I think what we're seeing is that oppressed people of the world, like, not that anything else that's been happening is sort of disconnected or insignificant, whatever, but I think we're at a watershed moment where all these oppressed peoples around the world have found, okay, this is the thing, what their experiences looks familiar to me. Oh shit, these people see the same thing. Then we're, you know, all the it's almost like this awakening that all our struggles are very, very, are very familiar and are caused by the same systems.
And it feels different, man. And I'm sure you fellas can attest to that, right? So, like, you know, God, even just a year ago, if you had told me in September of this year that there would be enormous demonstrations for Palestinians in the United States, worldwide at this scale, I would have been like, that's very optimistic. I hope to share your hope one day. It feels different now, man.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, on the kind of like grimmer end of it, in terms of like the intent of the Israeli government, that also feels a little different. Like they're saying things out loud, and they're behaving in ways and doing things that are. They're making the genocidal intent very obvious now, right? So, like, both the bad feels different, but also the good. The good feels very different as well.
Yeah. No, 100%. And I'm sure y'all agree, and, like, everyone's talking about it, that the Israel right now is very much acting like that kid, that bully, who's always gotten away with everything. So now they're just saying everything out in the open, because, oh, we've always said this, but we've never got any pushback. So now, like people are talking about how, like, the PR machine's starting to fall apart. Like, the propaganda is just comically bad because it's always worked. But now people are, you know, they understand that, you know, what they represent. I mean, in saying that, you know, we still get the hardcore, like, Zionists and the liberal Zionists in the U.S. that are still pushing the narrative, pushing, you know, the propaganda, whatever. Because it's just entrenched in the way like the politics works in the US. But like I know exactly what you mean, because as hopeful as we all are seeing like just the millions of people coming out in solidarity, the flip side also feels like an existential like dread. Like the idea that one day Israel is just gonna be, you know, fuck it and just literally just wipe out and quote unquote turn it into a parking lot, like they've come out and said, seems very real. Seems like at any moment like that can actually happen. So it's about balancing like those two things. We can sit here and say, like, oh, you know, we're gonna win, like it's just amazing. But unless we keep doing these things that are inspiring this hope, the flip side is very real as well, I feel.
You know what gives me fucking hope? The fact that the IDF is scared shitless of Hezbollah, and the fact that they haven't accomplished their fucking goals in Gaza, right? So, like, the resistance, the armed resistance that is taking place, especially in Gaza and also in southern Lebanon, here's the thing. The IDF is just not a good military. It's just not a good military. Right. They're overly reliant on air supremacy. They're overly reliant on high tech. They don't have the basics. Right. And so they're uniquely weak against an organization or group that is adopting the Viet Cong strategy, which is like half guerrilla, half conventional force. That's Hezbollah's whole MO. That is. And Hamas has, as obviously they're getting technical training. It's not Israeli propaganda to say that they are. They absolutely are. They're just a bad army.
Yeah, I think the goals of Israel's invasion of Gaza has never really surfaced. I think they have really poorly planned what they are doing. Yeah. And I think they don't really know what their end game is, which is why you get all these competing statements from Netanyahu and other ministers in the government, and then Mark Regev, who's like a spokesperson and advisor to Netanyahu and all this kind of stuff. Like, there's all this stuff flying around right now because I think they rushed in because they wanted to mass murder Palestinians in Gaza, and they wanted to reassert the kind of hallowed respect, you know, and fear that they believe that their army instills in the region. After it was utterly humiliated, like several bases, you know, several, you know, outposts, all the kind of intelligence infrastructure and kind of military structures keeping Gaza penned in as a prison were eviscerated by Al-Aqsa flood. And that caused a huge problem for them. And they rightly saw it as a massive, you know, attack on their legitimacy and their stability in the region. Because what does that show? It shows, you know, what T was saying, that Israel's fighting force is not as ready to defend the borders of Israel as otherwise it would have been believed. So I think what they're doing in Gaza now is basically day by day, they're seeing how much they can get away with. They're trying to inch forward. They're trying to, you know, root out certain Hamas tunnels and capture, you know, maybe certain commanders and whatever. So far, it looks like that hasn't been very successful, because otherwise they would have been trumpeting those kind of successes. Mm-hmm. And they haven't been doing that very noticeably. So I think one thing I read in the Financial Times yesterday, and this is where I'll finish, is that they aim to actually take over Al-Shifa Hospital, which is the biggest hospital in Gaza. For many weeks, they've been propagandizing about how the Hamas control center is underground. They released a completely fanciful 3D animation supposedly depicting this. And, you know, they've bombed the hospital several times. They've killed many civilians who are sheltering. I think there's at least 50,000 civilians sheltering there at the moment. Before we hopped on to record, all of the power in Al-Shifa went out. It was a complete blackout. Doctors were, you know, doing surgeries, not only without anesthetic, which they've been lacking for ages, but actually like electricity. You know, many, many patients who have been mauled by Israel's bombardment will perish right now as we're speaking, basically, because of what they're doing to this hospital. Very noticeably in that Financial Times article, an Israeli military official was quoted by saying that taking over Shifa Hospital would be a symbolic victory where they can plant their flag and pretend that they have defeated Hamas, cool. Pretend that they have, you know, submitted Gaza, which is not true. As T pointed out, the resistance is very sophisticated and holding up. Obviously there's a complete asymmetry. They're not able to like repel the invasion, but they are able to inflict heavy losses on Israeli armor and infantry as they advance through Gaza City. So I think that's kind of where their end game is at the moment. Obviously, that can change and no one can really be sure. But I think that's what we're really looking at, is they want to kind of destroy the means of life in Gaza, these hospitals, schools, and this kind of thing, and basically you know, occupied for however long they can, and then get out and pretend that they've won a war, basically.
No, 100%. Just a few notes on that. Like, one thing that you talked about, T, about the IDF really relying on tech and like the sophistication and like these global arms they're getting from across
air supremacy
and stuff. I remember my dad was a troop for 35 years, right? He was in Afghanistan, and when he came home, I remember we were watching TV together, and an ad for like Ancient Aliens came on or whatever, and he was telling me how much he hated that show, which is a really random thing for him to say. And like, why? He goes, oh, you know, on this, they basically put everything down, all the pyramids, everything was built by aliens. Because he's like, no motherfucking alien built that. Because what do you mean? I was in Afghanistan and I saw human beings it was like 2010 at the time. In 2010, build incredible like military apparatuses with fucking rocks and shit. Like, are you gonna tell me that, you know, like, you know what I mean? So it's incredible how privileged people in the, you know, so-called West have this inability to exist without their comforts. Like, they truly do not understand necessity, right? Because you saw a lot of tweets coming out from Zionists. Oh, they say the power was cut out, but, you know, they did this, did this. I'm like, because they fucking got together as a community. Like, we saw in Puerto Rico after Maria. Like, they built like solar panel, like electricity plants out of nothing to power like their community. You know what I mean? Which is really incredible. And I think, like I mentioned, like in the like before, another big thing that the IDF and Israel relies on is the propaganda, is the PR machine.
Oh,
and
yeah,
since they're losing that, they're scrambling, right? So you might have the IDF that is an ostensible modern military in whatever sense of the word you want to use. But a lot of that is buoyed by propaganda, by PR. You know, they're the most moral army in the world. Look at all these Jews from around the world coming to serve and blah, 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 blah. But they're losing that. So this is why, that's probably also why they're scrambling to just throw things at the wall to see what sticks in the minds of people.
In terms of basic military doctrine, you know, I'm not an expert, I don't claim to be, but like, what does an IDF soldier actually do most of the time? They bully and break like a 14-year-old's arms, right? They stand around when insane settlers go burn out a house, right? Yeah. They act like shitty cops, right? Most of the time, yeah. Right? So when you're facing a guerrilla insurgency, that shit ain't gonna cut it, right? One thing that the fucking upper classes and generals of all the world have never been able to accept is the fact that you will never defeat a guerrilla insurgency, right? You will never, it cannot be done, right? You have to kill every single last person, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Not just that,
yeah,
but any of their sympathizers to the third generation, to the fifth generation. It cannot be done. Why? Because whereas the more powerful modern country, quote unquote, the upper classes and generals and all their fucking little wolves, whereas they have military goals, quote unquote, you know what a guerrilla insurgency's goal is? Survival.
Yeah.
the longer you live, the closer you are to winning.
It's like, I live this.
Exactly. And that is something that the generals of this earth, that the aristocrats of this earth just cannot get through their fucking heads. It is very funny. And obviously there's a reason why they can't get it through the heads, because they would have to admit that one day they will look out the window and there'll be the crowds with the pitchforks and the torches, right? It's inevitable, right? All empires fall. All kings will be beheaded. It's inevitable. It is a law of history. It is a law of existence, right? So all they got to do is fucking last. They just got to keep fucking, they just have to live. And the people of Gaza have been under the type of conditions, you know, especially since the Second Intifada. They're prepared for this, right? They're prepared for these conditions because this is where they live.
It's all they know.
It's all they know, right? Exactly. Whereas, again, the IDF, it's like some shitty fucking like club kid that spends 2 years like beating on 12-year-olds. You know what I mean? That's not a soldier. I'm sorry. It's not going to fucking cut it. And it isn't cutting it.
it's a little bit beside the point, but I like all the pushback against Israel being in a quote apartheid state. But then we're seeing all the Afrikaners joining the IDF because Israel's not an apartheid state. Someone was joking that what a lot of the Afrikaners are seeing is like they lost in South Africa, they lost in Rhodesia, they lost like in Angola. So they're trying to look like fifth, like the fourth time's a charm or whatever. But just very, very interesting.
It's true. It's Rhodesia all over again is what it is. So like you have the international like reactionaries coming to in support of them. I saw a video or show a clip or whatever, a picture of a bunch of ex-US soldiers or whatever going overseas to like volunteer with the IDF or some shit. And like, it's Rhodesia, it's Soldier of Fortune all over again. Yeah. It's a great analogy, Leroy.
I wanted to talk about because I know we've seen, there was an event or something that happened the other day with a burger chain here called Burgatory. Very, very good establishment. One of the owner, the CEO, he's Palestinian descent. And one of his locations, the one in Caulfield, that just so happens to be like the biggest Jewish community here in Melbourne, was burnt to the ground. Which is very, very sad. He came out and did a whole, he did a video of him talking, basically saying like, you know, they targeted me, whatever. But he was very, very professional about it. Like, he wasn't angry. He's like, this is what they do. Don't come out and make a scene or whatever. Just keep marching. Just keep, you know, singing out loud. Just keep doing what you're doing. Basically saying like, this is, you know, we're winning. Like it's getting to them. But basically don't cry for me, you know, get out there and march. Has there been much of that in the US, or at least in Virginia or whatever that you're seeing?
Oh, like attacks like that?
Yeah, I mean, like
the normal stuff, like Sikhs, unfortunately, getting attacked and beaten again because Americans are fucking stupid. The people getting surveilled. It's apparently like starting to get really bad on college campuses right now. With the left-wing Jewish organizations getting suppressed, actually. It just happened, I think, earlier today. I don't recall which school, probably a couple of schools, but some of the big schools in the Northeast have removed the charters of Jewish Voice for Peace and these left-wing Jewish groups. Again, in the service of combating anti-Semitism, U.S. colleges are dissolving Jewish organizations, right? This is the insane world we're in. This is the Huff gasoline world we're in, where I cannot get over this. My voice is going to crack. The images of police beating the shit out of Jewish people who are protesting genocide. Yeah. You know, who is the fascist here? Like they accuse the left of being pro-Nazi. Who is the Nazi here? Who are the ones beating the Jewish people, the Jewish activists in the United States? For fuck's sake, Lord have mercy.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that you're seeing as well, particularly in Germany, I reckon that.
Oh my God, they need to sit the fuck down, Germans. Like the German government, they need to sit this one out.
Yeah, like this is giving cover to their internalized need to express their bigotry. So you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, you know what I mean? Like they obviously have this latent like anti-Semitism, and this is sort of giving cover, whether they're conscious of it or not. And it's quite remarkable. And there's something, like, I don't know if y'all agree with this, but something I was thinking about the other day, that when you're thinking about Zionism and the establishment of a Jewish state of Israel, if you're looking at like the Holocaust and the first people to go, they were the intellectuals. They were Jewish intellectuals who would have been ostensibly anti-Zionist, right? So once that sort of population of people were eliminated, that would have passed down like these teachings and like this whatever, you're left with the radical Zionists who flip the other way. You know what I mean? Like, I hope that makes sense.
I don't know if I agree necessarily, mostly because I think Israel has always been, especially since it's like formal foundation post World War II is as just a arm of Western imperialism,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I think there is the kind of there. Of course, there's the sectarian element to it, right? That's obvious. That's there. There's also the reactionary element. But let's not forget that, you know, at least in the beginning, it was the Soviet Union that was the strongest supporter of the State of Israel at its founding, more so than the United States. The support of the Soviets.
We have to thank Stalin for.
Yeah, I know, for real.
Another brilliant intervention into world.
I know, right? God, right? So I see it more as kind of like it's a tool of. Or I guess at least it's become more explicitly a tool of Western imperialism so much as an expression of sectarian dominance, right?
Yeah.
One of the reasons for that is the way that, say, Ethiopian Jews of the Beta Israel are treated in Israel. These are people who are also, or the fact that, you know, if you're a member of the Reform denomination, right, in Judaism, you're treated differently than you are than someone who's more orthodox or a little bit more conservative, right?
Mizrahi,
the fact that exactly. So, like, I think the I honestly think that white supremacy is a more central feature of the Israeli state than sectarianism. I really believe that.
Yeah,
I think that's absolutely right. And just on some of the things that you guys have been bringing up recently, I think. It goes back to what I was saying before with like the climate of racial McCarthyism that has been created ever since October 7th. And it actually makes all people who have any sort of contact with this, you know, conflict in any way, shape or form less safe. Like it makes Jews in the West a lot less safe that the governments of these countries and the peak Zionist bodies are conflating the State of Israel and its every whim and action and, you know, statement as the authentic will of 100% of the Jewish community. Again, that's obviously why groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, of which I'm a member from afar because I really admire what they do. And they're very, like, you know, organized, principled political activities. You know, that's the importance of what they do, which is reclaiming a sense of Jewish identity that's drawn from, you know, history, which is the history of their religion and the history of their community in the West, becoming a persecuted racially, you know, kind of basically like, you know, oppressed minority. And a lot of Jews, as a result of that, were always of the left and were always very critical of things like nationalism and you know, imperialism, these kinds of things that enforced their oppression at home. So it's definitely driven a rise in Islamophobia mainly, but I am also concerned by some of the things that I've seen, like, you know, Yiddish cultural centers, for instance, in New York getting spray painted and things like that. You know, these things have nothing to do with Israel. They have nothing to do with Zionism. And in fact, as a result, have nothing to do with Judaism. In the sense that, like, you know, Israel is presenting it as, like, you know, the kind of single representation of Judaism. It's really dangerous and it needs to stop. And the thing that we need to do as the left is organize everyone around the anti-racist solidarity that the Palestinians and the anti-Zionist Jews have been demonstrating so powerfully, and that's how we actually defeat this, because, you know, it could be, you know, Muslims and Palestinians in the West today, but there's always, you know, a next target. There's always a second.
I'm so glad you said that, Rev. Like, truly, the only people celebrating right now are genuine Nazis, right? They because they see their opportunity here, right? If you follow their, like, if you follow their propaganda, as like, if you engage in any kind of anti-fascist activity, you know, or if you're, you know, I think it's important to stay aware of, you know, always remember who your local Nazi is, because, you know, you never know what might happen. I say this from the city of Charlottesville, right? they're thrilled, right? They know the opportunity that this can present to them. They can, you know, and we've seen actually in the United States at a few demonstrations, we've seen neo-Nazi organizations, far-right organizations go to these events and trying to promote their message. Of course, the actual hard, organizers and activists, again, many of them Jewish, recognize these people and these little factions are immediately isolated. Now, the fear, of course, is that because these demonstrations are getting so much bigger, people, since it's not just the usual suspects, who know the names and faces of all the, local fascists in their town, it's possible that just some random motherfucker could like be walking down the street in one of these rallies, gets handed some literature, and that's the start, right? That's the poison pill. I think it's really important what you said, Rev, how like that the attacks against like these cultural centers or, things that are just not related to the state of Israel, like not only does that not support the Palestinian struggle, but that is anti-Semitic. Like that is racist.
Yeah. It's a crime.
right. That is also the enemy. Right. So I just, just echoing your thoughts and it's important to stay aware of that element, especially in the bigger demonstrations. There are many sophisticated neo-Nazis in the United States, believe it or not, who have done the reading, right? I've had the misfortune of talking to some of these people face to face before at demonstrations, when you do your shouting matches, right? There are very sophisticated ones among their number who know the kind of opportunity this presents to them, right? So staying ever vigilant that this kind of vulgar anti-imperialism doesn't sprout up that, can be taken advantage of by nefarious actors.
Yeah, it's a bit like that that Tucker Carlson anti-war, faction, you know what I mean? That these people are anti-war because it creates more like immigrants and refugees and like all that bullshit. But you're 100% right, man. We don't need this as a movement. Like, we need to be moving forward and be building this movement in solidarity with fellow oppressed people, because everybody is affected by this. Like, this Israel's attack on the Palestinian people right now also affects Jewish people all around the world because of those neo-Nazi factions, of people who are just looking for any excuse to, and not that they necessarily have Palestinians with solidarity with Palestinians. They're just using any excuse to be able to be anti-Semitic. You know what I mean? And we don't need that. We need to be moving forward in solidarity with all oppressed people. Like, it's as easy as that.
Well, look at the United States. Who are the ones, what I would say to someone who they're not a fash or whatever, but they're starting to wonder, well, maybe it's the same. But like, well, who are leading the demonstrations in America right now? Like, who are it's Palestinian groups and Jewish groups, right? It's Jewish people getting arrested. It's Jewish organizations being suppressed. It's Jewish leaders being surveilled, being fired from their jobs. I think your phrase racial McCarthyism is a very apt one, honestly, because we're experiencing that in the United States, and I guess and y'all in Australia too. Are people losing jobs and stuff? Is like, how is the repression? Because the repression is starting to amp up here in the States right now, and I think it's probably gonna get really bad really quick. What's the scale down there right now?
So there is definitely like a concerted effort from the Zionist lobby in particular to demonize anyone who is expressing even the mildest pro-Palestine sentiment or ceasefire and criticism of Israel's clearly indiscriminate and, in fact, targeting of civilian infrastructure and civilians themselves in Gaza right now. But fortunately, it hasn't, I think, turned towards like a huge mass institutional thing, in the sense that, for instance, this morning I read that Columbia, which I know you've been alluding to, T, Columbia University has banned their Students for Justice in Palestine, as well as Jewish Voice for Peace, student chapters on campus. There has been an issue like that at one particular university. I think I'm forgetting, but there was one university in Australia that tried to ban a meeting because it used the term intifada under the Zionist lie that obviously this means killing all Jews and removing Israel, this kind of thing, when really all it means is mass popular protest, which is what's happening in the streets completely peacefully every Sunday in Melbourne. So they tried to like ban a meeting of students, you know, about the issue that's happening right now. Obviously the students and the staff who are supportive, many members of the NTEU, which is the Higher Education Union here in Australia, are very strong on this issue and have been coming as a contingent to the rallies, for instance, as well as organizing on campuses. They're not going to abide those kind of things. So yeah, in a way, I'm glad that it hasn't been as bad as it otherwise could have been so far. But one thing I am paying attention to and I'm really worried about is how Peter Dutton, who is the leader of the Liberal Party in Australia, which is in opposition currently, but has a huge history of Islamophobia specifically, is going to leverage this, especially heading into the next federal election. But he's done things such as call for the deportation of all non-citizens who attend pro-Palestine rallies, which is extremely inflammatory, obviously. He has called, you know, for the police and all this kind of stuff, like the intelligence agencies to investigate, you know, people. And he's obviously running the kind of lie that all of this makes Jews in Australia unsafe, like pro-Palestine demonstrations are directly threatening members of the Jewish community, even though most prominently at those demonstrations are many Jewish speakers who head the rallies, many Jewish groups themselves who are taking part in them.
Like, so we can't overemphasize that fact, like that the people leading this. So
yeah, so it's really disingenuous, but it's really dangerous because we know already from what we've spoken about on the last podcast that the Labor Party isn't ready to fight any kind of anti-racist fight. They already lost. They already sold out the Indigenous struggle in this term of government in Australia. And, you know, there's no way that they're going to fight Peter Dutton on migration, which is, you know, something that neo-Nazis in Melbourne, of which there's a very active group called the National Socialist Network, they have already latched onto this. They've already created banners echoing Peter Dutton's comments about migration numbers and how, you know, we need to reduce the number to ease housing costs, which is a big crisis, just like everywhere else right now. And we need white only space. This is obviously drawn directly from German Nazis. So yeah, I'm very worried about that growing into a more kind of prominent part of political quote unquote debate in Australia. And I think it will. Yeah.
And one thing I'll add as well is, everything that Rev said is 100% correct, but also there seems to, I don't want to say a complete media blackout, but the media presence isn't as much as you think. I remember like at the march, like Rev, I don't know if you noticed a single helicopter flying overhead, taking any pictures.
There wasn't a single commercial news helicopter flying overhead. They're always really noticeable at mass rallies like that. So for instance, Invasion Day, which I've mentioned many times before, there's always choppers recording to get you, you know, aerial shots to put on their 6 o'clock news, but none. There also wasn't any coverage by the ABC, by the Liberal masthead, which is kind of like the equivalent of the New York Times down here, The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. And we're talking about, these are the biggest demonstrations in the city for years, like both Melbourne and Sydney, as well as actually all the other cities like Brisbane, Perth, have had record rallies in support of Palestine this year. But just like record rallies in general, if you know what I mean, for some of those smaller cities. So yeah, it's really interesting how they've tried to deliberately undermine the mass movement by not publicizing it. I think that's a concerted effort. I don't think it's an accident. Leroy and I have talked about this before, but there's actually like a secretive directive that the Department of Defense can issue in Australia called the D notice. And just given how no one covered what happened over the last weekend until The Guardian released like almost kind of like a narrative article just a couple of days ago, actually, you know, I think we can, you know, at least discuss that this is something that might have been issued. And that notice basically bans discussion of something, a particular threat to national security, in the press.
Wow.
Yeah, 100%. And I'll just add on to that. I remember telling Rev at the time at the meeting, that at the rally, that it was surprising that there weren't more like police. Like there wasn't a massive police, or the police presence wasn't as big as we thought. Because I remember, you know, a couple of years ago at the Black Lives Matter, they were lining the streets. It was incredible. And this time there was definitely police, but it wasn't as much as you think. But then when that news or those ideas of the D-notice being in place or being implemented made a lot more sense, because nothing is going to draw attention to a situation than massive police presence. You know what I mean? I don't know. I found that interesting. But,
that's really interesting. Shit.
Yeah, I think the thing there is they're trying not to antagonize the movement. Like they're trying not to radicalize it, basically. And they're doing that, you know, I think, in the hopes that eventually it kind of stalls and dissipates and this kind of thing, which is why I think the decision by, you know, the main kind of Palestinian activists behind organizing these rallies to hold them on a weekly basis and continue to try to like mobilize more and more people has been very wise.
Yeah.
Because it is the type of thing that, you know, typically you would see like one or two mass demonstrations and then they'd kind of peter off. But now we've had at least four, and they swell in size each and every time. So I think there is kind of at least, you know, the intention to try to not publicize it very much and also not cause the movement to do more things like sit-ins or pickets and whatever that would actually cause more disruption, basically.
Yeah. No, 100%. We're getting kind of long here, so we'll wrap it up in just a second. But I think that last point speaks to something you always talk about, T, about Kwame Ture's quote about organizing versus like mobilization, that like you can move people to rallies, but if it's not backed by actual organizing towards like the goal, like it's just gonna fizzle out. You know what I mean? But there's still a lot of work to do. And I've even said it, like maybe we can finish on this note talking about like what we want to see more from the rallies or what they can be doing better. But I remember after the rally last week that we went to, my takeaways were that we need to have these rallies every single week, at least up to Invasion Day. So that's the January 25th, 26th, whenever it is. For a couple of reasons, obviously there's another 2 months till then. So just consistent like barrage of rallies, but also tying the struggles together, like tying the concept of settler colonialism, not only what's happening here in Australia, but tying that also to Gaza, to tie like this international colonialism, international reaction and apartheid and everything together. Because I think that'll go a long way to radicalizing, not even radicalizing, but just awakening people who might not actually be aware. So I think that's a big opportunity. And I think also to echo one thing that your partner said, Rev, as well, like the speakers having clearer demands of what they want, not just, you know, obviously everything they're saying is very emotionally charged and like it, you know, it really like rallies everybody up and like, you know, we get into it and it's very emotional, but also ask for like, you know, the blah, 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 but also we need a ceasefire. We need to ask for this, and we're going to be out until we win this. And then when we get that, then we're going to keep rallying for this next thing. You know what I mean? As opposed to one of my biggest fears, and I think I tweeted about it, is that ceasefire gets sort of watered down from like the aim of decolonization, right? How like during the Black Lives Matter rally, we had like abolish the police, but then it kind of, you know what, we'll actually defund the police. Actually, you know what, you know what I mean? By people within the group, like giving that inch, like we can't give anything, like, and we can't allow our slogans to be used in that way, used against us to water down the, our aims and things like that.
Yeah, I do think that the organizers behind the rallies have been doing an excellent job, and I'm fully supportive of them. You know, the weekly actions have been really important, and drawing more people into the struggle specifically and learning about Palestine, anti-colonialism, all the things we've been talking about. But I do want them to kind of focus more narrowly, I think, at the moment on pressuring the Labour Party, because it's insane what they're getting away with right now. People, like, we should not normalize this or allow it to be naturalized at all. It is not normal for supposedly, ostensibly progressive political parties to be giving carte blanche to what more than 800 scholars and experts, including Israelis, have called genocide, and what the UN has warned several times at this point, and several, you know, high-ranking UN and human rights officials and things like that have resigned, issuing letters and statements to this effect. They've all called this a genocide, or at least a risk of genocide. Now we've seen more than 11,000 Palestinians destroyed by Israel, terminated for no reason, no reason other than, you know, the fact that Hamas, you know, actually is a resistance movement, which Israel can't, you know, abide by, you know, and needs to reassert its kind of military dominance in the region. And I think, you know, what I'm trying to say is that, you know, Palestinians in Gaza and these videos that we're seeing every day of children, you know, men, women digging through rubble, trying to survive outside hospitals while they're being rained with bombs, marching from northern Gaza to southern Gaza and then being bombed from the sky on those marches. These people are not legitimate targets. They are not Hamas. They are not, you know, militants in any shape or form. And these, you know, parties like Labour and the Democrats are giving so much cover to what is an extermination campaign, and a campaign of collective punishment beyond debate or anything like that. And not even calling for a ceasefire is a huge crime. It makes them complicit. So we need to be, you know, at each of these rallies, finding ways that we can get everyone who's turning out to crank up the pressure in between the rallies, in every week, you know, like things people have been doing,
right,
calling their officials, writing letters, you know, obviously posting online, but more and more doing sit-ins at people's offices. Like there was a fantastic sit-in at Richard Marles, who's the defense minister here's office, which was actually led by anti-Zionist Jews and indigenous activists as a kind of coalition. So I think we need to see more of those actions to make it as uncomfortable as possible, like you were saying, T, for them to continue their support of this war.
Yeah. And I think on that note, what Rev said, like even from just an electoral standpoint, if Labour were to come out right now and just say, you know, we're considering the need for a cease, even if it's some milquetoast that we're very troubled by what's going on in Israel, ceasefire seems like it might be the only, like something really, they'll win the next election. It's as easy as that. But they won't even do that.
I think the most important development has been this integration of labor unions engaging in anti-imperialist activity, right? Strengthening radical reform movements within labor unions or increasing militancy in organized labor, especially along anti-imperialist lines, would be a tremendous development in their own political consciousnesses and their own political practices. And so, like, I just, you know, as difficult as it will get and it can get in the United States and Australia, we just got to remember, like, anytime you feel like giving up, just remember, like, the Gazans haven't given up. The Palestinians haven't given up. It's been 70 fucking years. They have not given up. There are elders there that still have their fucking keys from their old homes, right? That they were expelled from, right? So if they, under like genuinely existential, this is the end of our people lines, right? If they, even the face of all that, if even in the face of all that, not only are they continuing to fight, but they're continuing to smile and to laugh and to have kids and to take care of their elders and shit like that. Like, if they can do it, man, like, so can we, you know, like, so can we, you know, as rough as it might get, like, so can we.
Yeah.
And like, just all the love for them. Fuck.
100% yeah. perfectly said. Yeah, I mean, again, we're getting kind of late here. We could talk about this for hours, man. So we'll probably wrap it up there. And we didn't even talk about Latin America and how a lot of Latin American countries are leading the way in, like, solidarity. Totally. You know, shout out to Petro, who's been consistent. Shout out to a lot of other countries. But on that same note, AMLO has been really bad on it. But we could have that conversation.
I always talk shit about AMLO on our shows I put myself vindicated.
Yep, the Senator Colony of Mexico. Yep. Anyway, that's a whole different conversation. But like I said, we'll wrap it up there. Thanks for tuning in, for everybody listening. Thanks for staying this long, because usually we cap it about an hour. Rev is just so beautiful to look at. We have to just keep talking.
Oh, come true. On.
Stop.
Man,
who's actually a lot taller in person. I was surprised that, like, not that he's super tall, but for some reason he doesn't seem as tall, like, you know, through the lens, but yeah.
All right. I look kind of cute.
Yeah. No, shout out to Rev again. Thanks, buddy, for coming.
Thank you so much.
Grandparents for marching. To your grandparents who've been involved in these actions for decades as well, like through their own direct action and improves employment stuff. Rev told me about some few stories that they were involved in, some major things that happened here in Australia, which was pretty dope to listen to, to find out totally. About. But
it's the kind of the memory of the class, you know?
Yeah, 100%.
Oh, yes.
100%. Like we've been saying, if you've been out to marches, keep marching, keep going to rallies, keep speaking up Palestine's name, you know, from your full chest, from the rooftops, all oppressed people, everything that's going on in the Congo, Yemen, you know, our plight in Puerto Rico, Sudan, everywhere. Because it's all one struggle against colonialism and capital. So it's the same thing. We can't let anyone, like, be forgotten.
Drive a wedge.
We can't drive a wedge, and we can't let them win, because that's how they win, by driving the wedge.
There's always something to do, right? Like, if you can't march for whatever reason, or, you know, whether it's work or you don't have time or anything, like, there's always something you can do. Like, you can spread the message, you can talk to your friends and family, you know, you can do your five calls. Like, there are things you can still do. Like, you know, don't feel like you can't contribute or support these people. Like, you can donate a little bit of money. I know times is rough, but even a dollar helps. Like, there's all kinds of shit that you can do besides, like, going on the marches. Like, definitely go to the marches, but there's so much you can do. Like, and the thing is, like, here's the beautiful thing about the struggle, right? And I'm talking not just the Palestinian struggle, but the struggle, right? The struggle of struggles altogether, is that it's not reliant on one person.
Exactly.
Thank God for it, right? It's all of us doing our own little bits, right? Because a bunch of regular ass people doing a little bit becomes a lot of bit. And eventually it's a fucking overwhelming, like, I'm losing track of my thoughts, but you get what I'm saying. And I'm sorry for interrupting your closing, Leroy.
What's that Mao quote? The spark can lead to a
prairie fire, baby.
Yeah. Again, thanks for tuning in. Shout out to everyone's been out. Shout out to our amazing, beautiful Jewish comrades leading the way, to our indigenous comrades here in Australia and across the world. Keep going out, keep posting all this information in solidarity. But until next time, hasta la victoria. Peace.
Later, y'all.
Mi gente, thank you for listening to this edition of Machete Mate. If you support what we do, consider showing your solidarity at patreon.com/machetemate. You'll be helping us out by allowing us to put out more and better content, while also getting access to our Discord community, our more casual and personal After Dark episodes, and any other projects we might have down the road. If not, we still love you, so show us some love with a good rating and review on whatever platform you spend time with us. And as always, hasta la victoria.